Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Food, wine, and travelers everywhere, welcome to On the Menu Radio. We're delighted that you're joining this morning. This is Peter Haig, co-hosting single-handed once again, but expecting Anne back on the show within just a very short time, so we're looking forward to that. We're starting out this week's show with something that I found. In last week's show, we finished up talking to Chef Conrad Meyer at Bedford Springs, and I thought there was more of his interview, and sure enough, I found it. So that's the way we're going to start the program today. Then we're going to talk about the spa there, and then we have some wonderful new material for you. So I hope you'll enjoy it. And if you're in Europe, we wish you good evening. If you're in Australia, we wish you good day on Monday morning, and we're delighted that you're with us.
Now, Chef, how did you end up coming to this place, which is not exactly on the main drag, shall we say?
No, not at all. But when we first came together, my company, Benchmark Hospitality, I found out that we will be actually managing this operation, and I thought to myself, well, let's have a shot at it and see how it goes. So last year in June, I met my general manager now, Ricky Popora, and he brought me into the building, and I looked at trailers and construction workers and many, many other things which were not very attractive, but I saw the building and I fell in love with it because there was structure, that there was something which was really, really cool looking. And when I walked into the building, into the lobby itself, where we're sitting here right now, this is kind of the spirit there. I felt this right away. I thought to myself, there's a lot of things to be done here.
To be seeing ghosts. Yeah. Like that piano that's playing in the
There's
corner.
Nobody sitting there, and there's nobody sitting there. So I do not know. Let's don't look over there. But when I first came in here, then there was no piano music, but there were a lot of dust and a lot of rocks. And he showed me around through the whole building, and I saw all the outlets. Like they're not supposed to look like, but they're going to be beautiful, and it has become very beautiful. When you look at the restaurants right now, it's just amazing. It's breathtaking, actually. Just
oh, it
to
is.
See this, yeah.
It's over $200 million.
Yes, almost.
No, 120.
Yeah, 120. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about how you decided on what kind of food to serve here.
Well, the food itself was, when I first met the owners of this property last year in September, and I spoke with them about, cuisine and cooking. It was kind of, they wanted me to use the local farmers and the local produce people. And that's what I'm doing right now. So we're staying a little bit, not a little bit, quite a lot actually, with the locals. And the cuisine is reflecting on that. Like right now, the fresh tomato season. And we have our local lamb, actually. We bought a couple of lamb at the auctions the other day. And it was kind of a fun thing to do. So we're trying to support the locals and helping them out. And this is how we design our menu. So we have our trout farmer here. We go on with bison meat for our burgers. We have our tomatoes up from the Smith farm. He supports us with that very well. We have Hidden Hills cheese already.
Really?
It's on the menu, and it's beautiful cheese. You would not believe that. But
did I have that at lunch?
You might have had a little bit of that. Yeah, there was some on the cheese board itself. So we talked to Lori, the owner of the farm, and we said, listen, we want your cheese. Let's give us some samples. And we tried, and it was beautiful. So this is what we're doing in the neighborhood. Like, and you'll be surprised just driving through the little city or going to a little store, just like you meet the farmers and they say, hello, Conrad, how's it going? And we're coming by and bring you some new products and things like that. So it's very interesting.
And you also said that you met several chefs who actually cooked here in the glory days of the Bedford Springs
yes,
Hotel too.
Absolutely. And I was introduced to them by Todd Gillespie this year in April when I came here. And one of them is Wes Fix. He's the owner of the Carriage House. And we became very good friends. He helped us out quite a lot with just let us cook there, and for familiarizing trips and for little function going over there with the employees and cook our meals and things like this. So he helped us out quite a lot. And he was a chef here, yeah, in the beginning of the 80s. And he was just, he was very much surprised how it looked everything. When I walked into the kitchen, he said, it's just a beautiful thing. And he felt the spirit here as well. And he said, he can imagine how we must feel right now, just walking back into so fresh and everything is renovated. And then also Chef Andy from US Foods, he helped us out quite a lot. And he was a chef here as well. So it's nice to meet all these people, and not just the chefs, but also servers and people who used to work in the 70s here at the front desk. And
they're still in the area.
Yeah, still in the area. Charming ladies who were here waitressing like, 30 years ago. And it's beautiful just to talk to them about the stories they had in these days.
Now, you have a lot of ideas for programs around the food and restaurants here.
Yeah.
Like the cooking classes, Jeff's Table. Could you tell us about those?
Yeah, one I'm involved in very much, of course, is the culinary program, which we're trying to get classes together and get the locals and people from far away to learn how to cook with us. And what we're doing right now is also a culinary package where you will be dining and wining weekend or during the week. And then you will actually be cooking with me in the kitchen. And our main kitchen is set up to do so because we have a chef's table in there, a marble table, and all the equipment we need to create a great meal. And you will be coming into the kitchen and get your hands dirty and be with me there. And there will be recipes for you. And you will be eating and having a good wine with me and having a good time.
When does that start?
It's starting right now. I had several over the weekend. Next week I have another couple coming on Wednesday, and then we go through the weekends. I have larger ones coming up, like Boots Allen and Pfizer. They come here for team building, and they are being surprised when they have to learn that they have to cook their own food. But it's a lot of fun. The people start out and then they just have a glass of wine in them, a couple of d'oeuvres, and then we just have good time with knives and fire and skillets and all kinds of things.
So Chef Conrad, I'm glad I managed to find that section, because that was an excellent overview of the menus and the other things that are going on in the kitchen part of Bedford Springs. But one of the most exciting things about the Springs is the spa. It was always a place to take the waters, but there was never really a full-service spa there. Now there is, headed up by a wonderful young lady called Veronique. And here's her interview with Anne about what's happening in the Bedford Springs spa.
Veronique Paquet is manager, spa director, rather, of the Springs Eternal Spa. And we talked before over breakfast, but I want our listeners to know a little bit of your background. First of all, tell us what you do here at the Eternal Springs Spa.
Well, Anne, as spa director, I oversee the day-to-day activities in the spa. I oversee a staff of approximately 40 individuals. I'm responsible for the guest experience from the moment that a reservation call is taken to the experience of the spa to the final closure of their experience. So I oversee all of the body treatments, massages, manicures, pedicures, various services at the spa.
Now, this place is a very special place, but it seems almost that you were meant to be here. Could you describe how you got here, what your background is?
It's a very interesting background. I am actually a world history and political science graduate from the University of Colorado Boulder, and the magnetic pull and the fusion of the spa emphasis at this beautiful historic property was the perfect fusion for me. I was previously at a destination spa in Wisconsin prior to my arrival here in Pennsylvania, and with the goal to market our spa as a destination spa location with Mineral Springs, the emphasis of history and political science behind the scenes of this project, it was really a dream come true spa for me.
Well, you seem to be perfect for this whole setting. This is a very special place. I said that. Could you tell us why? Tell us about the springs. Tell us about the sense of history in the therapies.
Well, for hundreds of years, people have been bathing in the various mineral springs here on site, and people were traveling all over the country to be healed by the various springs. During our construction, we tapped into an eighth spring, and it gave the name to the Springs Eternal Spa. And this eighth spring is a very pristine, pure water form that we have uniquely fused into the spa with all of our services, from our manicures and pedicures, hair services, our hydrosage is all using the mineral spring water, as well as a unique bathing ritual that we have incorporated to honor the history of bathing in the waters, but also providing our guests with a very therapeutic spa experience prior to their service. So we're honoring history and tradition. What worked in the past is working today, coming back to the basics, honoring these mineral waters. We've also developed a special guided hike that takes honor to the Seven Springs, and we visit the springs and inspire what was done in the past with these springs and healing, and show our guests these various locations on property.
Am I going to do that?
If you have time, absolutely.
Oh, good. Now, there are specific therapeutic properties to each of these springs, right?
There are, definitely, and those are all available on our website. The seven different springs are listed with the different conditions that were used for the treatment of different conditions, which water was used for which condition. That's all available on our website, sure.
Now, did you research historically what they did with the springs?
Well, I didn't have to do that, Anne. That was done for me. There's been there's been a series of recordings of what was done for different ailments, some from the Magnesia Spring and the Sulfur Spring and the various different springs. There are recordings of actual testimonials.
Now, when did they come about?
Well, I have actual data testimonials from the early 1800s.
Really?
Absolutely, yes.
So, how exciting. For a history major, this is incredible.
Like I said, it was a dream for me.
Now, you had another project. Since you have the springs and you did research on that, how did you get the idea that there were also unique botanicals in the area? Tell us about that.
That's right. We developed, we did a land survey and found various indigenous botanicals and plants in the area that were inspiring to create a body care line. So our goal was to use technology of today, create a signature line that was created with ingredients right outside our doorstep. And we used this body care line in conjunction with the mineral spring bathing experience. So it's really providing us with a uniqueness to the property. And you can experience ingredients right outside our doorstep, from black walnut. We have a black walnut.
Black walnut?
Yes, a black walnut ginger body exfoliation, which you'll get to experience later today.
Oh, wow.
And a cucumber root hydrating mist. It's an Indian cucumber root. Honeysuckle grows wild outside our doorstep, so we used a lot of honeysuckle.
Veronique, you were telling us about the honeysuckle. It gets out of hand sometimes, doesn't it? But you said you modified it.
Well, honeysuckle can be a strong essence, and we really wanted this product to be gender neutral, so all of our guests could enjoy them. And so it's a very soft, mild honeysuckle undertone infused with some cucumber. So it's very clean and fresh. It's lovely.
Now, how did you suddenly figure out that you could create all these potions out of botanicals in that short period of time? That's just amazing to me.
Well, I was very lucky in having the support to execute this product very quickly and efficiently. I have a background with my family. My mom developed a skincare company, so I definitely had some insight into the process of working with various labs in testing the samples and creating a wonderful product. And the product line is all natural, which is important. And, it was so much fun creating the labels for the product. We infused history, again, my passion, and used...
Yeah, talk about that.
It's really interesting. It used a template of our wallpaper that is in the spa throughout, so it has a signature look to the spa. It was really fun to develop that process and see a very wonderful product line from shampoo, conditioner, body wash, lotion, body butter. We also have a signature honeysuckle cucumber candle, beautiful exfoliation black walnut ginger exfoliation in our hydrating mist. So it's a complete line.
Oh, that sounds, I can hardly wait to experience it all.
Great.
So we have a special place, and you bring together 70 special talents and experiences. Knitting it all together is, you have a philosophy of balance. Could you explain that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, what we're trying to do with the history and honoring history, but bringing in technology, it all goes back to the basics of balancing in life, a complete wellness from nutrition, inner peace, and outer vitality is truly my spa philosophy, and that's what we're trying to do every day here at Springs Eternal Spa, from a staff level to a guest level.
Well, listeners, this woman works hard to make everything much easier for you and very relaxing. So I'm delighted to have met you, and I'm inspired by you as well.
Well, thank you, Anne. That's so kind of you to say. I appreciate that. Thank you. And I encourage our listeners to make their reservations for spa services about 3 weeks in advance. The spa does fill up rather quickly, on the weekends especially. And so I encourage that. Thank you, Anne.
And will eventually they be able to make reservations online? Or?
Absolutely. That is soon to come. Soon you'll have a feature on our website to make your spa reservations online.
And that website again?
Is www.bedfordspringsresort.com.
So if you go down to the Springs for the spa services, you can be sure that you're in good hands. And now it's time for us to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to onthemenuradio.com. Don't forget that you can get in touch with us anytime by sending us an email to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and you can check out many of the other services available through the website at www.onthemenuradio.com, including all the past shows and lots of other exciting things that we're in the process of adding. Coming up, for example, is a highlight section, which will feature some of the interviews from long past, but with exciting people like Heston Blumenthal and Patrick O'Connell, especially there for you to directly access them. If you've been to the website recently, you'll have noticed that the whole update section has been changed now to new, so that it's easier to access, easier to see what's going on the menu land. Recently at On the Menu, we've been hearing a lot about a state that a lot of people almost ignore, forget about when they're trying to name all 50 states, the little state of Vermont in New England. And Crescent Dragon Wagon, who was our guest just last week, lives there and told us something about it. Lots of other people have. You'll recall a few weeks ago, the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company were on the program as our guest. Well, I caught up with two other great new ventures in Vermont that I thought were worth including in the program. So here they are. Good morning, Liz Lovely. What a wonderful name, and how nice it is to have you join us this morning.
Well, good morning, Peter.
Now, we were talking off the air, listeners, and I did say to Liz, these are just about the world's best cookies. I don't even eat cookies, but I didn't want to share them. So, Liz, would you tell us a story of how this came to pass?
Absolutely. My husband and I actually were in the dot-com kind of era of business, and he was a web consultant, and we had a business that was booming and then failed during that whole disaster. So we did not know what to do, and we were both working jobs we didn't really like, and I was feeling like I should do something more creative, and I started making cookies because I'm pretty obsessed with cookies. I mean, I'm a baker from my grandma and my mom, but I'm obsessed with cookies. So I kept making all these cookies, and my husband was saying, you have to start giving these away. This is, you're going to make me really fat. And I also did these chocolates, and one day I had these cookies and leftover chocolate, and I decided to put chocolate on the cookies, and It was sort of a match made in heaven, and I tried them out on all my friends, and I decided I really should take a shot at this. And I rented a house with a kitchen separate from our own house kitchen, and I started my business out of there, and that was in Pennsylvania.
Okay, and since then you've moved to Vermont?
We have closed down the business 4 years ago, and we moved it up here to Vermont, yep.
And, I mean, how big a business is it? How many million cookies a year do you make?
Well, I make about 3,500 a day.
Oh, my goodness.
And they're pretty big cookies, so they're not like little mini cookies. It's a lot of work that goes into that 3,500 cookies.
Yeah, well, tell us some of the flavors are really quite remarkable.
We have five flavors, and one is Cowgirl, which is a soft chocolate chip cookie dough. It's like eating cookie dough right out of the bowl. And then we have a cowboy cookie, which is an oatmeal walnut chocolate chip cookie with chocolate on the bottom and the top.
Now, you missed out. My favorite comes first. That's the macadamia.
Oh, Macadamia Mountain.
Oh,
yes.
They are magnificent. They were the ones that went first.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I ate all those myself. We gave some of the others away, but I ate all those myself.
I'm sure you were feeling a little bit of a buzz after that. There's a lot of Vermont coffee in there and a lot of chocolate.
Okay, and then there's a traditional ginger, too?
A ginger snapdragon, which is like a ginger snap taste, but the texture of a gingerbread. And we also have a peanut butter classic, which is a typical peanut butter cookie, but it's also loaded with chocolate.
Now, as your husband, Dan, told you, we actually originate our program in the Pittsburgh area, and I understand that you originally have connections here.
I was born in Pittsburgh at Allegheny General, and my parents still live in Rochester, Pennsylvania.
You going to say hi?
Hi, Mom and Dad. I grew up in Western PA in all kinds of towns. My dad's a minister there, and so we moved around Western PA a lot.
Okay, now, we forgot something. We forgot something about these cookies. What's the special V word about them?
The special V word is that they are vegan. And you would not know that, hopefully. But they have no animal products. We don't use butter or eggs or milk of any kind.
And how do you make them so delicious?
Well, we say it's trickery.
It's trickery, okay.
We use a heart-healthy fat replacement called palm fruit oil.
Okay.
And we replace the eggs and the butter with that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's really remarkable. And why vegan? I mean, did you just think that this was a market thing, or is it something that you believe in? Or?
Well, I'm vegan. I've been vegan for about 11 years. My husband is not vegan, but when I started, I was really tired of eating this one kind of vegan cookie over and over and over. So I sort of tried to make my own that were better.
Oh, I see. So that's sort of how you got into the business to begin with.
Yeah. So I started out making the vegan cookies, trying to find one that really tasted like a normal product, because most vegan products don't taste like normal. They wouldn't trick like your mom or dad. They wouldn't trick your friends who aren't vegan. So that was really my mission, make a product that's awesome but also happens to be vegan.
I think you succeeded. And 3,500 a day of these go out now. How do people get them?
You can buy them at most at your local natural food store or Whole Foods Market, but you can also buy them on our website at lizlovely.com.
And there's only one downside that I can see.
And that is?
These are fairly expensive cookies.
They are premium.
They are premium.
They are. We won't lie about that, but they're certified organic and fair trade. And they're mostly handmade. There are only four of us working here.
Okay, there you go. Now, I understand. I mean, it's an absolutely sensational product, listeners. But be prepared for the fact that the price is $3.99 for two cookies.
Yes, and we call that portion control.
I guess. Well, I mean, I was eating them about a sixth of a cookie at a time.
Yeah, see, that's the way to go. If you keep them in your freezer and you rip, just take a little hunk off at a time, then you won't take down the whole package.
Well, I kept them in the refrigerator.
That's good, too.
Is the freezer better?
Well, either one. We like them from the freezer. but they kind of taste like a chewy candy bar from the freezer.
Okay, all right, yes.
But we also have like a pretty big supply, so we couldn't eat them all fast enough in the fridge at our house.
Come on. Yeah, you and you eat lots of them yourself, I suppose. Huh?
I do. I would like to say that I would be tired of them by now, but it's just not true.
And are you dreaming up some new ones?
We are. Next year, I am planning on launching a triple chocolate. It's going to be a chocolate cookie with chocolate chips and chocolate on top.
Oh, wow, wow, wow.
So it's going to be a little, we're calling it migraine madness right now, but I don't think that's the real name. It's a lot of chocolate.
Yeah, well, when the macadamia one and the cowboy one have chocolate on one side.
And the peanut butter. They both have, they all have chocolate on the bottom, and then they're also piped on top.
There you go, yes. Yeah, well, there are wonderful cookies that I grew up on in England, which are chocolate on one side and a digestive biscuit on the other side. And
oh, really?
You could get them in either milk chocolate or dark chocolate. I love the dark chocolate ones.
It's hard to find cookies like that in the U.S.
I forget what they're called in England, and I'm sure they still make them, but I also bet they don't taste nearly as good as they used to. memory in your memory, all things always taste better.
That's true.
So there's a triple chocolate coming out.
There is, and we might also have some special cookies that are coming out just on the website only.
Okay.
And possibly, I'm kind of dreaming up a whole line of chocolate covered things, like chocolate covered macadamia nuts and ginger pieces and. I'd really like to get that out for the holidays, but with only four of us, we don't know.
Now, do you do custom cookies too?
We don't do custom. We do custom orders for weddings and corporate gifts, but we've never made custom cookies for people.
I mean, you make them for corporations, is that a special order, or can I have something special on it if I want it?
You could have special packaging.
Okay, that's just packaging.
The cookies themselves, there's a lot of, I mean, our production facility is pretty big, so to just turn on everything would be pretty hard to do a tiny special order.
Okay, I got you.
So that makes us like, we're the master of very few things.
There you go. Now, where are you in Vermont?
We are in Waitsfield,
which is
near Sugar Bush,
which is near
the ski slopes.
Okay, now where's that in relation to Burlington?
That's about 35, 40 minutes from Burlington. It's a little south central.
Okay, because most of the population in Vermont is up in the north, correct?
Correct. So we're kind of in between Burlington and Montpelier.
Okay.
But a little bit south.
Yeah, I've been to Vermont a few times. I was in the state capital, Montpelier.
Yeah, Montpelier's great.
And it seemed like a really nice little town.
Yeah, very progressive towns up here. You know, lots of little local restaurants and a lot of food artisans.
Now, do you know Crescent Dragon Wagon?
I have never met her.
Oh my goodness! Well, you should look her up at the best website is called cornbreadgospels.com.
Okay.
She just wrote a wonderful book all about cornbread.
Wow.
And she's just a wonderful person, somebody that you really ought to get to know. And the Vermont butter and cheese people, you said you do know them, right?
Yes. Great people,
and they were guests on the show. Allison was a guest on the show a few weeks ago, and she knows Crescent. So there's quite a mafia of you guys, and everybody's saying we have to get to Vermont. We must come and visit Vermont.
Oh, you would love it.
So
you could do a little food tour just in Vermont.
Well, that's exactly what we would have in mind. But let me ask you a question on the air, because my co-host Anne might listen to this program. She's laid up right now and not able to participate. But how soon does it get warm enough for people who are kind of soft?
Well, I would say April or May. May is a very safe bet.
Okay.
But March is a little dicey still.
Okay. Well, can you hold on? Hold on just a second for me, because my other phone's ringing. Okay, so what's the answer?
So the answer is I would say May is a safe time. Although you do have mud season, which is not an attractive season in Vermont. Everything melts, everything gets muddy. But I'd say, you know, if you want to see Vermont in all of its splendor, you got to come in the fall.
Okay. So spring and fall are the good
times.
Spring
and fall. I mean, summer's beautiful. Anytime between, you know, May and September, you're going to have a good time. If you don't like the cold.
If you don't like the cold. But lots and lots going on in the food business and new products, new restaurants, that kind of thing.
Yeah, lots of good local food. There's an artisan bread baker that we trade with, actually. We barter. They take cookies and we take bread called the Red Hen. I mean, you can just see such amazing products made up here.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to it, and if we come up, we'll be sure to find you.
Absolutely. Stop by.
Now, your website is...
Somehow we got cut off there, but the website is www.lizlovely.com. And wasn't it a pleasure to talk to Liz and know that she and her husband Dan grew up just next door. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
We're back again, listeners, with On the Menu Radio. Again, you can keep track of us at all times at www.onthemenuradio.com. You can send us email to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and we'll be delighted to hear from you. On the Menu doesn't have Vermont on its mind. It just turns out that we have two wonderful guests close together who are from this state, which really must have a tremendous amount of charm because there's so much going on there. We hear more about it every single day. But having just talked to Liz Lovely about cookies, and our new interviewee, Chris Bailey, says he knows and likes and eats these cookies, we're going to deal with a slightly more mellow kind of product coming from Vermont, which is wonderful things made from pork and ham and things like that, made by an organization called the Vermont Smoke and Cure Company. And CEO Chris Bailey of that company is on the line with us. Chris, tell us a little bit about how this business got started.
Sure. Well, it was a family business for about most of 40 years. It was called Roland's, and a lot of the old-timers in the area still know it as that. And about 7 years ago, they sold it. The owner had it for a few years, and he started having some challenges and had put it on the market. And this is the last federally inspected processing facility in the state doing work for local farmers. And at the same time, the Farmer's Diner was getting ready to open its first diner that focuses on putting as much food on the table that's grown locally and processed locally. And so the folks getting ready to open the diner said, you know, we need to have this facility open. And so it fit with the mission of the organization to keep local farmers doing well. And so they purchased the smokehouse started making products under the Farmer's Diner label and serving them in the restaurant. And then a couple years ago, we were having requests for really another set or this similar products, but under more of a Vermont name for those parts of the state that didn't know about the diner. And so we created the Vermont Smoke and Cure label, and it's really started taking off since then. We got out and got in front of some buyers that from places like Switzerland and Germany, where ham is a big part of life, and they had wonderful things to say and started buying us into New York City, and it's been kind of off to the races since then.
Well, this is an incredible story. Now, there's got to be a little secret in there somewhere.
Well, we like to say the magic is in the maple. We buy maple syrup from about 10 miles away from us, and really build the flavor profile around it, or rather the original family did. And so there's quite a bit of maple syrup in the brine and the bacon and the ham, and then it's not very salty, either of those. And we smoke with maple wood and corn cobs, which are both very mellow, a little bit sweet smokes. And so the effect is not an overwhelming smoke, not an overwhelming salt like you might have some folks who think of a Virginia ham, and a nice hint of maple in there.
Now, the products are bacon and ham, and then also some sausages too, correct?
Yes, we do a summer sausage as well as some fresh sausages. What really sets the summer sausage apart is that we still do a full 12-hour fermentation, which helps bring the pH down, which is what makes it a summer sausage. Some of the bigger companies will just add an acidulant or acidifier directly in. It just gets them the pH, but it misses out on a lot of flavor development in the meantime. And so we have a really nice, tangy, clean-tasting summer sausage. And then our smoked pepperoni, which just showed up in the November issue of Gourmet Magazine.
So how did you learn how to do this, Chris?
Well, I actually don't do any of the production.
Okay.
So the answer is everyone else does. There are 10 of us there. Our plant manager has been on board for 7 years. And he, actually the son of the family that started it is still our landlord. So we haven't had to ask him for any directions in a while, but they're still around.
And your background is really interesting. You started out not exactly intending to be the CEO of a ham and sausage company, I guess.
No, not definitely not specifically. But I don't know, 7 years ago, set myself on a course that this kind of is what I was looking for. I had been farming for 7 years and then had to leave that for some family reasons. But just that I really wanted to be on the business side of things and help create products that would be so good that folks would be willing to pay a little extra more, and that could be passed on to the farmers to pay them a fair price for their livestock.
Okay, so the key thing is to have an economy that's sort of self-sustaining.
Yeah.
Because everybody gets a fair share.
Exactly. You know, if farmers can't afford to make a living making the products, sooner or later they're not going to be around making products of that quality.
Now, what is it about Vermont that all this is happening there, do you think?
I think it's a combination of things. We have, our rural landscape interspersed with the villages and towns, and people both really appreciate the landscape and the farmers that are working it. So there's a real ethic in Vermont of buying from foods from local farmers, and you know, quite a few companies have been able to get started, and if they have a good product, then a lot of people do buy it, and so then gives you a great place, kind of an incubator before you head out into the wider world.
There you go. Now, our old friends from the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company, would they be someone that people sort of look up to, who showed the way?
Definitely. They're real pioneers, and you know, people like them, when we went to Chicago, for instance, and doing a tasting, and people say, "Oh, well, it's from Vermont. It's going to taste good." You know, at least there's a predisposition that people are going to give the product a try, because everything they've had from Vermont thus far has been so good.
Now, tell our listeners, you're in a town with a rather unusual name, in western Vermont.
North Central.
North Central, okay.
And it's Barry, and it's you had the good comparison of a more famous or well-known town that people have heard of, Wilkes-Barre. So it's spelled the same way.
Okay, and
old granite town.
And it's not close to the farmer's diner, though, even though they were involved in its development. You said the farmer's diner is about an hour away.
Yes, it originally was in Barrie, and it was a tiny location, though. It was a great place to test the concept and see if people wanted to come and eat locally grown foods in a diner atmosphere, and if we could find enough vendors to have a significant menu that was mostly from local farmers and producers. And we were able to answer, after a couple years of operation, that the answer to both of those questions is yes, but then had to decide that, you know, at 60 seats, it's really hard when you're, you know, mashing your own potatoes and peeling carrots in a postage stamp kitchen, that you just can't do that at that scale. And so we closed in Barrie and have opened up down in Queechee in a 120-seat restaurant with a huge kitchen, and are doing very well down there.
Great. Now, you are involved in the Farmer's Diner, too?
Yes. I help out there still with some of the financial and marketing things there.
Okay. Now, there's another secret ingredient in here, as well as the maple syrup and the not-too-much salt, and it's those four-legged creatures who were involved in the production of the product. Tell us a little bit about your hogs.
Sure. Well, for the Farmer's Diner, we work with a single supplier up in Quebec, so it's still pretty close by, and they have just excellent quality in both the bellies and the hams. And then for the Farmer's Diner products, we get about half of the pork from Vermont and New Hampshire grown hogs. And the population of hogs is so small and varies throughout the year that we've kind of found a middle ground and hit about 50% over the course of the year.
Okay, now you mentioned before we went on air that the website is on the way.
That's right. It will be up by Thanksgiving, and the URL will be www.vermontsmokeandcure.com.
And in the meantime, if people want to get some of these wonderful products, they need to call?
Yes, we can still ship items to you, and welcome calls to our number at 802-476-4666.
Do that one again, nice and slowly.
Sure. 802-476-4666.
And listeners, you really got to try this. I mean, it's really excellent. And there will be a store locator on the website. In the meantime, it's available in quite a number of places, I think. So probably the smart thing to do is go to your local, your best local gourmet retailer and say, do you have Vermont Smoke and Cure products? And if not, you ought to go about getting them, right?
Well, that would be great.
And you're in some famous names in New York already. Just tell us a few of those, Chris.
Sure. Belducci's and the Food Emporium and Eli Zabar's.
And they're at the top of the list, listeners, as you know. So, Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. We wish you continued success. I'm guessing you want to grow, but perhaps you don't want to grow too big?
Correct, yes. We, you know, want to get to what would probably still be a tiny scale by the food industry standards, but a little ways bigger than we are now.
Great. Well, be sure to let us know when the website is definitely up. We'll put it on the Menu Radio website. And you must also let us know if you have any new products come along that you'd like us to sample. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today, and we wish you continued success with the Vermont Smoke and Cure Company.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate you having me on.
And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back, listeners. You're with onthemenuradio.com. We're in the backside of the program now, but please don't tune off, because our next guest is one of the most fascinating that we've had for weeks. His name is AJ. I never did ask him what AJ stands for. AJ Rathbun. And AJ Rathbun wrote an absolutely wonderful book all about the subject of cocktails. We're live. A.J. Rathbun wrote this absolutely incredible book called Good Spirits. And just before we started recording, I asked him, how did he manage to create such an enormous, authoritative, and really quite brilliant book?
Well, Peter, let me tell you, it comes from a number of different sources. For one, I did a lot of research myself. I was very lucky, did a lot of shaking and making of great cocktails and drinks. But I also went to my friends, both those that I only know through books. I have a really nice collection of classic cocktail books and newer cocktail books that I went to time and again for research, for new drink ideas for the book, and also for parties when I'm throwing parties. And I also have a lot of friends currently that are bartenders or are really talented home bartenders, and I really drew on their knowledge, and I like to get new drink ideas all the time from them. I'm also really lucky in that my wife is a great bartender, and so she helps all the time. So really the book came out of this whole group. It takes a village of cocktail lovers to make a book like Good Spirits, I think, and I was glad to be a part of the process.
Now, how long did it take you altogether?
The writing of the book itself took just about a year, the initial writing, and then there's always the editing process, and worked a lot with the photographer and the designers of the book because they did such a fantastic job. But I would say that the book itself has been brewing ever since I turned 21 back in Kansas and started sort of exploring cocktails and drinking, I don't want to say full time, but more often than not. And so, you know, I've been writing down recipes, and I have all these little books that were just blank books that I always carry with me when I go into new restaurants or bars in case I hear of a new drink, and I'll jot down and talk to the bartender. So the book's really been brewing for quite a while.
Now, you say something important at the very beginning of the book about the fact that it's cocktails aren't just about cocktails. Cocktails are about conversation. They're about conviviality.
For sure. I truly believe that some of the best conversations I've ever had and most of my friends have ever had have come over a couple cocktails. I mean, drinking should be a communal affair and should be something that you do when you're having fun with your friends. And many of my memories, when I think back, also involve me and some friends having a few good drinks or cocktails. And so now when I have those cocktails again, cocktails sort of drive memories, and I'm always happy to remember those earlier occasions.
Now, you must know lots of bar chefs, I think they're called these days.
I know a few.
You know a few, and most of them hate to be called mixologists, I understand.
I think they do too. And
no, somebody told us that.
I've heard that before, and I've heard different names thrown around: cocktailians and bar chefs. You know, though, for me, I don't mind what you're going to call me as long as you're going to serve me a nice drink when I step up to the bar or step into the house.
There seems to be a new breed of bartender out there too. Have you noticed that?
People
who are really interested in producing new concoctions as well as paying respect to the old ones.
Yeah, for sure. And I love it that the really good bartenders still recognize the classics and they like to do their homework and they like to read the stories about the old drinks. But then they also understand that we're in a great new cocktail era, really a second cocktailing revolution, where we can get ingredients from all over the world and we can get liqueurs and liquors that we couldn't get in the past. And so the vast landscape of ingredients that you have to work with when making up new cocktails is amazing. And it's so fun when you go into a bar and you can tell that they're really, you know, they're into it, the bartender's into experimentation. It's also really fun when you go to a really good home bartender, because I think people are now bringing all this new knowledge and new ingredients that are available to their house. And I just love that. I love going over to friends' houses and having them say, oh, you got to try, I just made this new drink. You need to try it. It's great. I just think that's really fun.
Yeah, I have about 12 or 14 hot sauces that I use when I'm making Bloody Marys. And
nice.
Just the shake of this, a shake of that, a shake of the other one. They're really, in the local community, quite famous. But absolutely the very best Bloody Marys I ever had were made from fresh homemade tomato juice that my mother-in-law used to make from tomatoes grown in the garden.
That sounds amazing.
I mean, if you've never tried a Bloody Mary made with fresh tomatoes, you should absolutely try it. Now, you have to have a cedar. You have to have all the right equipment.
Sure, for sure.
But it's just absolutely amazing, and you don't want to drink one with V8 again.
Oh, I bet. And people, I think, are realizing that, two more, that fresh juices are just take a mundane cocktail and bring it up to, you know, heavenly heights. It can be that simple of using fresh juice instead of canned juice or frozen juice. And I think that it's really nice when you see things like that happening more and more and hear about things like that. And I love hearing stories about, you know, great cocktails made at home with things like fresh tomato juice right out of the garden.
Now, we had the opportunity to visit with a bartender who became quite, well, famous enough to have an article written about him in one of the national magazines like Food and Wine. His name is Scott Beatty, and he's at a restaurant called Cyrus in Healdsburg, California. And he loves to work with fruit and with other external botanicals. So he'll gather herbs. The day that we were there, he was making something that I guess you would probably call it muddled with fresh blackberries that he just picked that day.
He just seemed like
an outstanding guy.
Using the muddler is another thing that I love to see, because I love to muddle things. And we had three different kinds of mint in our backyard this year that we would use for all different kinds of drinks throughout the summer. It's really fun. And we also have a cherry tree, and so we'll pick fresh cherries and muddle them up in drinks.
Take us inside the book, because this is a fat book. This is not a book you can read from cover to cover. Take us inside it with your skill set and explain to our listeners why this is such a great resource.
Well, I think that it's really, and I like to put this out at the first, I think that professional bartenders would definitely like it, because professional bartenders like to read about drinks. But the book is really sort of angled towards the home bartender that wants to learn a little bit more about drinks, that wants to have some new drinks to throw at parties or to order in bars. And with that in mind, I really think of good spirits as a conversation over cocktails between me and the reader. And so there are 450 tasty recipes in there, but it's all surrounded by what I like to call party talk, sort of enlightened party talk. So there are stories and histories of liqueurs and liquors. There are some jokes, there are facts, there are some quotes about liquor. I mean, all these things, when you're having a good conversation at the bar, it tends to ramble and it's fun and there's information, but then there's also a little bit of silliness. So there's some jokes in the book, like I said. And so there are these great recipes, but it all comes together to be this conversation, as I said, between me and the reader. And I think that's really fun, even though it is quite a big book. So it's sort of like a long conversation that takes place over time.
No, I could feel that as I was reading it. I felt like you were talking to me.
Yeah, and that's what I like, because as I mentioned before, I mean, obviously, I love to sit down with friends, have a cocktail. I love introducing my friends to new cocktails too, of course, and just talking it out.
Now, you're described on the flyleaf of this book as a raconteur anyway. but you also have a real job?
I do. I have a day job too. I am lucky enough to work in the kitchen store at Amazon.com. So I'm surrounded by, on the good days, stand mixers and blenders and, you know, nice chef's knives and cocktail shakers and stemware. And I get to work and talk about kitchen products.
But you're also a poet.
I do have published a collection of poetry a couple of years ago called Want, from a publisher in San Francisco named Ziziva. And I still manage to have time to keep up with my poetry writing too, and hope to have a second collection at some point. I'm a busy guy.
Okay, so again, help us to navigate the different sections, because you've got an unusual approach to categorizing cocktails.
And that's another thing I should have mentioned earlier when talking about the book. I really wanted to, many of the bartending books out there are organized alphabetically, the drinks are organized alphabetically or by base liquor, so gin, rum, brandy. But I wanted to take sort of a different tactic, because when I think about drinks, I sometimes think about it more in genres. And so good spirits starts with the gold standards, which is just like the top drinks, the ones that are always going to be around. But then it goes into a different variety. So there are unburied treasures. There's a chapter that if you're looking for a drink that's from, you know, the early part of last century, the sort of golden age of cocktails, that's where you'll find them. There's a chapter called Fresh Faces, which are drinks that have come about and become popular or that I'm introducing that are newer. Then there are also chapters such as Pacifying a Crowd, which is all drinks scaled up. So the recipes are scaled for 10. So if you're having a party and you don't want to make individual drinks, that's where you'll find those recipes. There's a chapter called Dinner for Two, which are all recipes scaled to just two people, and they're all sort of more like romantic recipes or slightly coy recipes. So I really wanted to put it into genres so that home bartender could pick up the book and say, it's cold outside. Today I want a hot drink. Well, then they go to the chapter that's called Turning Up the Heat, that's all like warm drinks that'll take the chill off on a cold day.
And you might need that in Seattle, huh?
Yeah, some days we do. We really need drinks that have umbrellas in them, most of all.
There you go. Well, isn't there a cocktail? Don't you frequently get pineapple cocktails that actually
come? For sure, you put a little umbrella in them, definitely.
And I really think that should be frowned upon.
No, yeah, sometimes it just gets in the way. And you got to be careful. You don't want someone to get that umbrella like stuck in their nose or something.
Now, when you were done, did you wake up one morning and say, oh, my God, I left something out?
Oh, yeah. And
okay,
I mean,
what was left out?
I didn't have a moment where I was, thought, oh, I forgot the Manhattan. What am I going to do? But since then, I have had moments where someone will come up and be like, oh, why don't you have the Smith and Kearns in there, which is, you know, like a Kahlua drink. And I was like, oh, I've had those tons of time. Oh, I feel bad I didn't put them in there. And then with the way the cocktail world is expanding so quickly, I mean, it's great, but like recently I've been drinking a lot, playing around a lot and drinking a lot of this French elderflower liqueur called Saint-Germain. And I love it so much, but I hadn't heard of it when I was writing the book. But now I'm like, oh, I feel so bad there aren't any drinks with this in there because it's so good. I wish I could introduce it to people. So there were some moments like that for sure.
Now, a lot of people are saying that the vodka generation is killing cocktails because vodka doesn't taste of anything. What do you think about that?
I sort of like vodka myself, and I know people are always like, well, it's a neutral grain spirit, so it doesn't have a lot of taste. But it does add a nice accent to drinks, I think, and it may not completely be on taste, but it gives the drinks a little more fortitude, which they sometimes need. And sometimes you have sort of a lighter liqueur, but you still want a drink that's serious. Well, then vodka steps up to the plate. And also, with the sort of expansion in flavored vodkas that you're seeing a lot of companies come out with, it really adds a nice touch, and it can add another wrinkle of flavor, a couple of different notes into your drink. So I'm all for vodka. But really, Peter, there's really not a liqueur out there that I'm probably not all for.
Yeah, there's not one that you really miss, huh?
No, I'm not one of those people who, you know, you always meet people who are like, well, I like cocktails, but I don't really like gin, or oh, I don't like tequila. I, you know, if it's pretty well made, I'm gonna like it no matter what.
Now, have you ever toyed with the idea of serving cocktails throughout a multi-course dinner?
Definitely. Oh, for sure. When we do that, when we have people over at home, we'll have a different cocktail before dinner, and then usually offer a different one in the middle of dinner, and then after dinner, I really like the, you know, Italian after dinner drinks, and so there's always a liqueur course too. So I think that's a great idea. And I think people are going to be doing that more and more as they realize just how much variety you can have with your cocktail and how well you can match it up with food.
Yeah, we had a wonderful visit with the, you know, the name is escaping me. Why the name is escaping me, I'm not sure, but it's one of the largest.
Could be those Bloody Marys.
No, they're a craft grappa producer. They were the people who pioneered single grape grappas. And why the name is escaping me, I'm not sure.
But I love the grappas.
But the reason I was going in that direction is we just tasted a relatively new vodka product called Bocage, B-O-C-A-J. And it's derived from a recipe that that I think Grandpa used to make.
Nice.
That tasted a lot like grappa.
Ah, that sounds great.
And guess what? This vodka tastes a lot like grappa. so you should look out for it. The founder of the company is going to be on the show in a few weeks' time.
Oh, excellent. I will look out for it. And it's B-O-C-A-J?
B-O-C-A-J. Comes beautifully packaged in a little purple velvet sack. I'll whisper this quietly, but ours came in a plain brown wrapper through the mail because we live in Pennsylvania where it wasn't available at the time.
The fact that it has my name in it, too, makes me want it even more, I have to admit.
There you go. So, AJ Rathbun, you have been just a wonderful guest and a delight. I could talk to you all day, but before we go, I'm sure our listeners would like to know if you were asked to name, out of all the cocktails in the book, what are your three favorites? What would they be?
People always ask me this, and this is going to be one of those sort of evasive answers. And I never say a favorite because I'm testing and tasting so many new cocktails all the time that I'm worried that the next cocktail I have might be my favorite and then I'll feel bad because I called something else a favorite. But what I can do instead is I can tell you the last three drinks that I had that were in the book.
Go ahead.
I love doing that. So the last drink I had was one called the Oriental, which is a classic cocktail from the Unburied Treasures sections. And it has a little bit of rye in it and rye or whiskey, whichever you have, combined with sweet vermouth and orange curacao and a little bit of fresh lime juice. And you shake it all up and you strain it into a cocktail book. But I love this cocktail for the taste, but I also love the story behind it. And the story is that supposedly in the 1920s, there was an American engineer in the Philippines, and he got really bad tropical fever of some sort, and everyone thought he was going to die. And then a mysterious Dr. B showed up and saved his life. And to pay the doctor, the engineer gave him his most prized possession, which was his old family recipe for this cocktail called the Oriental.
That sounds great.
So there was that one. Also, the other night I had some friends over on Halloween to hand out candy to our neighborhood kids, and while we were doing that, we had a nice cocktail called the 14 Juliet, which is Armagnac, Cointreau, and fresh lemon juice.
Ooh.
It's very good. It's that, it has that strong brown liquor base, but then the tang of the lemon juice, very nice combo. And we also had Commando, which is a little bit of whiskey with some fresh lime juice. Also a little Cointreau, we were following that, and a little bit of Pernod in there that gives it just that subtle sort of Pernod anise flavor. So we had some of those too, and they were very tasty.
Well, listeners, get this book. It's called Good Spirits by A.J. Rathbun. You'll be able to get it very soon through the On the Menu website because I'm going to put it up there almost as soon as the program's over. A.J., thank you so much for joining us today. It was a wonderful conversation, and have one on me tonight.
I will, and thank you so much for having me, and I'm happy to come on anytime.
Bye. Well, boy, that was a long and exciting program, and we actually ran a little over the usual time today, but that's just fine. Peter recovered from his memory lapse, and the grappa he's talking about is Nonino, N-O-N-I-N-O, quite the best grappa that we've ever come across. So if you're looking for the best in grappa, that's the kind to get. And now it's time for us to say goodbye. It's been a long show. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you'll come back and join us again, same time, same place, next week.